You are listening to a session recorded live at the American College of Emergency Physicians Scientific Assembly, held October 5th through the 8th, 2009, in Boston, Massachusetts. Now to our session.
Good morning and welcome. On behalf of the ASAP Educational Committee, it's my pleasure to present our next speaker, Dr. Amal Mattu. For those of you who have seen him, he's really one of our most enjoyable speakers and always one of our highest rated. A couple quick bookkeeping announcements. As many of you know, ASAP allows pharmaceutical and other companies to underwrite portions of the scientific assembly through an educational grant provided to the college. The Educational Meetings Committee plans the programs and selects the speakers. Companies are then allowed to select the session they wish to underwrite. The organizations underwriting these courses have not had any involvement in faculty selection, planning, or implementation of the educational program. Their financial support of this course in no way implies endorsement of a product by ASAP or the faculty presenting this lecture. ASAP would like to thank Boehringer and Ingelheim for their generous support of this course.
All right, thanks. Thanks, Eric. All right, well, welcome, everyone. My voice okay in the back? You guys hear me okay? All right. All right, well, welcome, and again, thanks for having me. We'll kind of jump right in. The actual title of this talk is Remember the Patient You Saw Last Night. How many of you have ever had the pleasure of hearing that coming in for? Yeah. It's usually not followed by, hey, great cost-effective workup on that guy, right? Or, there's a bouquet of flowers waiting for you in the back office. Usually it's like, yeah, there are lawyers on the phone or something like that. So anyway, we're going to spend some time talking about the worst reason and perhaps the most common reason that we sometimes, unfortunately, have to hear this. Remember that patient you saw last night. And that has to do with missed 8 cases of ACS, all right? And so I want to start out by just giving you what the objectives of this talk are. If you look on the jump drive, the handout, there's some very formal, elaborate objectives. But in reality, there's only 2 things that I want to accomplish with this talk. I want to spend a little time talking about what kind of things we, as emergency physicians, need to know to better protect our patients. But I also want to spend time talking about how to protect yourself, because it's very important to remember, and for the younger physicians here, the residents, it's especially important to remember that every time there's a physician or healthcare provider interaction with the patient, there's actually 2 people at risk, right? One of them is the patient, but the other, unfortunately, in our system, is the healthcare provider. So there's some very important things that you have to be aware of to minimize risk to yourself. Because otherwise, these are the guys that are going to come after you, right? Johnny Cochran and all of his buddies. I think Johnny Cochran probably died of a missed MI at some point. But not only is it the legal field that's now coming after emergency physicians and other physicians, but the media has gotten into this also. And the media loves to talk about our screw-ups and our misses. In fact, you might remember this. This is the front page of the USA Today in October, just a few years ago. And this front page article was all about a guy who had a missed MI. He presented somewhat atypically. And the name of the emergency physician that sent him home is on the front page of the USA Today. And his cardiologist is on one of the inside pages. All right. How would you like to be on the front page of the USA Today for something like this? All right. I can think of a lot of other reasons that I would like to. Actually, I probably wouldn't want to be on the front page of the USA Today. But anyway, the media has really, really gotten involved in this, and so people love to talk about this. So it's very important. Okay. Now, before we get started, I need to introduce to you what I consider to be the 2 cardinal rules of cardiology, and these are mandatory acceptance for anybody who wants to remain seated in this auditorium. Okay? If you can't accept these 2 rules, I really, really suggest you get up and leave, because you'll be very upset with me by the time this conference is over. There'll be a tremendous sense of dysphoria when you leave here. Okay? And I don't want that to be your memory of ASAP in Boston. Rule number 1, you can't diagnose every acute MI. You just can't do it. You can substitute ACS. You cannot do it. Rule number 2, you can't change rule number 1. All right? If you can't accept these 2 rules, please do yourself a favor and head out, get a croissant, or just take an hour break, because you're going to be very upset with what I have to say over the next 45 minutes or so. All right? And even with that said, people tend to get very, very upset with me when I give this lecture. And I think a big part of it is that some of the things I'm going to talk about, which are literature-based, have a tendency to make people feel like I'm burying long-held traditional beliefs. Okay? And so, you know, please don't take it out on me. What I want to try to do is present to you what the literature says about acute coronary syndrome, because we need to protect not only the patients, but ourselves as well. This is a little outline of what we'll go through, and I've been doing a bunch of medical legal consulting over the past 5 years or so, and I'm going to talk about some of the types of cases, some of the themes that we're seeing in the medical legal cases and in the literature as well. And a lot of it is focusing on what I'm highlighting down here, provocative and invasive testing. Okay, over-reliance on that negative cath or the negative stress test. We'll get to that in just a little bit. So first of all, just a little background information. We'll cover a little epidemiology. You have to get CME, so we got to do a little epi. 1.25 million MIs occur in the U.S. every year, and 80% of these present to our emergency. Well, it doesn't actually not, but it seems like 80% probably present to your emergency department. 80% show up in the EDs around the country. The other 20% go to their primary care doc's offices or cardiology offices, or their symptoms are so mild they never see a doctor. All right? Past studies indicate about 5 to 8%. That's my bald side, actually. All right. Sorry. All right. So past studies indicate that about 5 to 8%, probably 10, 15 years ago, the study said 5, maybe as high as 15% of MIs and ACS were being sent home routinely from the emergency department. Even the most recent studies indicating that we're really, really good with ACS indicates that we're still missing at least 2% of the ACS cases. Right? So I gave this lecture, I got to tell you, I gave this lecture to the medical staff at one of the community hospitals that I used to work at. And at the end of the lecture, I was asked, getting questions, and one of the primary care docs said, oh, great, I guess we're going to be admitting a lot more patients now. And I said to him, well, all you need to do is tell me what percent of your patients that show up in the next year with an MI you want me to miss and send home. All right? And he said, well, I don't want you to miss any of my patients. And I said, that's not possible because studies indicate I'm already missing 2% of your patients. So if you want me to drop it down to zero, then sure, I'm going to have to start admitting a lot more. And even then, I'm going to miss some. So even as good as you may be, you may have all of the latest, greatest technology, electron beam CT, 80 lead EKGs, right? Continuous ST segment monitoring, you're still going to miss at least 1.92%, according to the studies out there. Do the best you can, but just accept rule number one. You cannot make the diagnosis in every case of ACS. Okay, so there's a few themes that are associated with missed MIs. Patients with MIs that get sent home tend to be younger patients. They tend to have fewer cardiac risk factors, less typical symptoms. Their EKGs don't look all that bad. So you may look at this information and say, well, you know what? If I miss this person, they'll probably do okay. They're younger. Their EKG's not so bad. So maybe it's okay if I do miss some of these MIs. And it turns out that that's completely false, because when we miss MIs, even in this group, MI patients that get sent home have about 3 times higher mortality. So instead of about a 10 to 12% mortality, mortality in MIs that get sent home approaches 35, 36%. All right? And if it's an elderly patient, this is a stunning statistic to me. If you have an elderly patient, and we'll define elderly as over 65 for the sake of studies, okay, patient over the age of 65 with a missed case of ACS has a 50% 3-day mortality. 50% likely that they will be dead by 3 days from discharge. Tremendous, tremendous mortality. Now, we can't talk about MIs without talking about the lawyers that are out there also. So we'll talk about the lawyers. Just a little medical legal information. 10% of all of our paid claims are for missed MI, and yet actually a disproportionate amount of money that we pay out, 20 to 30% of the money we pay out is for missed MI. You'll be happy to know that we're actually not the leading, but we're the third leading physician group in terms of the number of times or the frequency with which we get sued. Primary care docs and cardiologists get sued more often than we do. But when we get sued, we have the highest payout. We pay more than $100,000 more per case, depending on the study you look at. And that's simply because society has a higher expectation for what we're supposed to do. There's this different standard of care with what we're expected to do. My wife is a primary care physician. And, you know, for the first few years after we got married, we'd sit at the dinner table. You know, kids weren't there yet, and so we'd talk about cases. And I work in Baltimore, but the closest hospital to where we live and where a lot of her patients go is near Annapolis, Anne Arundel Medical Center. It's a great hospital. And every night, you know, she would say, you know, one of my patients went to the emergency department and they did this. What would you do if they went to your emergency department? And usually I'd pretty much say, well, I would do the same thing that they did. And she'd say, well, if they came to my office, I would have discharged them with this and that. And I say, well, next time tell them to go to your office, you know? That didn't go over well. So we spent a lot of very quiet dinners the first couple. So we've learned not to talk medicine anymore. But it's a very different standard of care between what the primaries do and what we're expected to do in the emergency department. And that payout reflects that. All right. If you look at the medical legal literature, there's three major themes that are associated with missed MIs. Failure to recognize atypical presentations, failure to consider cardiac risk factors in high-risk groups, and over-reliance on negative tests, all right? And those are the three things we're going to talk about in this lecture. This is a low-tech lecture, all right? We're going to talk about simple things that you can decrease your miss rate by, all right? You can't eliminate it, but we're going to talk about how to decrease your miss rate, protect the patients more, and protect your patients. This says, even though the plaintiff is fully recovered, just think how much he can enjoy his health if you make him rich. All right, definitely the mindset of many in our society. Now, I'm going to start out by giving you what I consider to be the best mnemonic in all of emergency medicine. This is my mnemonic for history of present illness. Okay? Now, if you have T-sheets or some other type of system that gives you a system of questions to ask, then you're fine. But if you don't, by all means, adopt this mnemonic. If you make it routine to go through your HPI and you hit all of these different pieces of the mnemonic, I guarantee that when you walk out of the room, you're going to know what to do with that patient. You may not have a diagnosis, but you're going to know whether they need to come, whether they need to stay or go home. All right. And also, by the way, the most predictive factor in the workup for ACS or for chest pain in terms of predicting whether that patient is going to rule in or rule out is your history of present illness. And that's published in the most recent ACC-AHA guidelines. History of present illness trumps everything, including past workup, cardiac risk factors, including age, including everything. The number one predictive factor, most important thing you've got, is your HPI. Like those old-time docs in our med schools used to say, history, history, history. All right? So, my mnemonic, onset, location, duration, character, what makes the pain better, what makes the pain worse, activity at onset, what were you doing when it started, associated symptoms, and radiation. All right? Now, when you read a textbook on ACS, what you usually get is that your typical ACS patient has relatively gradual onset, the location, mid-sternum, left side of the chest, duration, 20 minutes up to a couple hours, character, substernal pressure, right, the elephant sitting on my chest. What makes the pain better, rest or nitroglycerin? What makes the pain worse, walking up the stairs, activity? What were you doing when it started? Most of us have learned that there's some type of activity at onset. Associated symptoms, shortness of breath, nausea, vomiting, diaphoresis, all of those questions. And then radiation, it radiates to the left arm, left neck, left shoulder, left jaw, and so on. But if you read the literature, you get a slightly different version of what actually happens. Onset in up to 70% of patients is actually an abrupt onset, not that gradual onset. And that may mislead you into thinking of maybe dissection or PE. If you're thinking dissection, you're going to hold off on anticoagulants, right? And that may produce a delay in your initiation of therapies. Location, up to 20% of patients have no chest pain but have upper abdominal pain instead. So one of the things I try to teach a resident is the diaphragm's not a concrete wall. Anything in the chest can produce belly pain. Anything in the belly can produce chest pain, all right? So how many people here have a protocol whereby if somebody shows up with chest pain, you get an EKG within 10 minutes, right? Most everybody. If you have a patient showing up with upper abdominal pain, especially diabetics and elderly, you should be getting that EKG just as quickly. Upper abdominal pain, very common. There's a lot of other isolated sites. Left ear, you know, left ear is interesting. About 8 years ago, we had an elderly patient with diabetes who presented to the emergency department with nothing but left ear pain. That's it. So, of course, he got sent to our fast track, and they looked in his ear, they did an exam, looked in his ear, it's completely normal exam, normal ear. So he got diagnosed with otitis media, right? Here's a prescription for amoxicillin. He goes out. A couple hours later, he comes back with worsening ear pain, and now he's diaphoretic. So now they get an EKG, and he's having an acute lateral STEMI. All right. Now, I'm not telling you to admit everybody with ear pain, okay? But just consider atypical presentations, especially in those elderly and diabetic. We'll talk more about that, okay? Duration, few minutes to few hours. All right, couple pearls I'll give you. If it's momentary, just like poke, 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 just a split second, it's very unlikely cardiac. And also, if it's been constant for hours, it's very unlikely cardiac. But beware the fact that many patients will say, yeah, I've been having pain for 3 days straight. And then when you really pin them down, what I say is, Mrs. Jones, you mean to say you're going to sleep with the pain, you wake up with the pain, it's there every moment of the day, unchanging, then oftentimes they'll back off and say, well, no, it's actually been coming and going, or waxing and waning. And that's a different animal. That's called unstable angina, right? So pin them down about that. Character. The classic crushing or pressure is present in about 24% of MIs and about 30% of unstable angina, but atypical descriptors are very common. Mild ache, sharp stabbing. Burning or indigestion is the word that's used when patients have proven ACS in 20% of MIs and 21% of unstable anginas. In fact, there's one article in the cardiology literature which indicated that if a patient, they looked at all the different descriptors for pain, crushing, pressure, squeezing, tightness, indigestion. What they found in that study was that if a patient uses the word indigestion, it had the highest likelihood ratio to rule in. Right? And that's one of the reasons why reflux is the most common misdiagnosis sitting on the chart of a malpractice case for missed MI. Okay, and I said this yesterday. Anytime you write reflux on the chart of somebody that you're about to send home, do yourself a big favor and just give yourself a slap. Okay? Because if you don't, somebody else will. Somebody else may. All right? At the very least, just think twice before you send home the reflux patient. Maybe it's an atypical presentation. Now, sure, reflux exists. I'm not saying you got to work them all up, but just think twice. That's all I'm saying. Think twice about that. All right? Here's another reason why reflux is so often misdiagnosed. 15% of patients get some relief, 7% get complete relief of their ischemic pain with antacids. What else? What makes the pain worse? Well, 15-16% of the time we misdiagnose this as pericarditis or a pulmonary disease because it's positional or pleuritic. And what about the reproduced pain, right? You've got some red flags, but the medicine team or maybe you push on the chest and that reproduces the pain, so no worries, right? Well, 15% of patients get some reproduced pain, 7% get completely reproduced pain with direct palpation of the chest. In fact, there's a rheumatology study by Disla, which is in your handout, right, where a bunch of rheumatologists came down to the emergency department, if you can imagine that, and they diagnosed acute caustic chondritis in over 100 patients using their criteria, and 6% ruled in for an MI. So even the rheumatologists diagnosing caustic chondritis aren't going to get this right. What were you doing when the pain started? Well, a lot of patients are involved in some type of physical activity, but emotional stress. Mrs. Jones was just stressed out. She was having an argument with her landlord, so it's just not cardiac, it's just anxiety, right? Well, there was a European study where they looked at over 10,000 patients that had proven MIs, and they looked at simply what was the patient doing when their MI pain began. And 7% of patients were involved in some type of emotional stress when their MI pain began. This is funny because it was a European study, so some of the emotional stressors that they listed were watching soccer penalty shootouts and other things like that. Okay, Mr. Jones was eating some spicy jambalaya when his pain began, so it's got to be just reflux, right? Same study, 8% of patients were doing nothing more than eating a meal when their MI pain began, all right? Another reason why we have a tendency to overcall reflux with these patients. Associated symptoms, shortness of breath, nausea, vomiting, diaphoresis, these are all very common. There's a couple of studies now that indicate that diaphoresis is the most specific of all symptoms. So your patient that's diaphoretic needs to be admitted and worked up, all right? So they tell our residents, chest pain plus diaphoresis. If your patient sweats, it ought to make you sweat, all right? It's almost always going to be an admission unless you've got a really, really good reason or a really good lawyer, okay? Belching. Studies indicate that almost half of patients that have their MI pain will describe an increase in belching. And that may be from diaphragmatic irritation from an inferior wall MI. And that's probably why so many of these patients have reflux type of symptoms. But again, just think twice before you write the prescription for the PPI or H2 blocker and send them out. You don't have to admit them, but just consider the possibility that you're being fooled. All right, radiation. We learned that pain radiates to the left side, and it does in many cases. I learned in residency that if the pain radiates to the right side, it can't be cardiac. It sounded great, very convenient. Not only is it not true, but the studies indicate that if the pain radiates to the right arm, it's even more likely to rule in than if it radiates to the left side. All right, there's a couple of cardiology studies that point that out. And worst of all is if it radiates bilaterally. The more it radiates, the more likely that patient will end up ruling in for ACS. So be very, very careful about that. Now, I've only talked about patients actually having pain so far, okay? But studies also indicate that up to a third of patients actually have no pain and instead have some other type of anginal equivalent or alternative symptom, especially diabetics and elderly in whom shortness of breath is the most common anginal equivalent. All right. So again, for all of you that raised your hand that you get quick EKGs with chest pain, if you have diabetic or elderly patient, you should be getting the EKG just as quickly in those patients with shortness of breath as if they had showed up presenting with chest pain. Make sure your triage protocols include EKGs in any diabetic or elderly patient showing up with shortness of breath. All right. Try to get that EKG. You'll be surprised how often they end up ruling in, and that's their anginal equivalent. Okay, now, we've learned all of these Framingham risk factors. We're actually not too far from Framingham. Everybody's familiar with these Framingham risk factors. I'm going to talk just briefly about a few of these. Male, gender. Now, while it's true that men are at greater risk, the studies consistently show that women are at greater risk for misdiagnosis. We tend to send home many more women, especially young women, that are having ACS than men. Now, there's some possible reasons. Women more often have no chest pain. Not really sure why. They're still trying to figure that one out. Isolated arm pain sometimes and atypical locations of pain is more common in women. Even if women have pain, it tends to radiate to the right side more often than in men. And for some reason, we less often get EKGs in women in the offices and in the emergency departments. And even if they go all the way to stress testing, women are more likely to have false negative stress tests. Some people think it's because women more often have single vessel disease, men more often multivessel. But that negative stress test is less useful in women, all right? And also women tend to present older and more often are diabetic. And these are big risk factors for atypical presentations. The bottom line is something that I've been saying since high school. Women are confusing, okay? So be wary, okay? Age, young patients, just call out a number. What's the youngest age people in this audience have seen ruling in for an MI, non-cocaine related? 18, 24? Anyone seen a less than 18? All right, so a couple over here. Right, so I learned in residency, 55 is a cut. No, med school, 55. Then in residency, they made it 45. And then they said, well, maybe 35. Now I don't know what the younger age to worry about is. All right? And only a minority of these are related to cocaine. A lot of MIs occur. Now, this concept of atherosclerotic disease in young people is not a new concept. They've actually known about this since the 1950s and 1960s. When soldiers were killed in the Korean or Vietnam Wars, they did autopsies and found significant atherosclerotic disease in a lot of these young, healthy men. Now, think about these. These are soldiers who are incredibly physically fit. They're running around battlefields with 50-pound backpacks on. They're incredibly conditioned athletes. And they've got atherosclerotic disease. Right? They didn't die of MI. They died in combat. More recent study. This is a study from 16 years ago now. 111 patients, average age 26, that were victims of inner-city violence, had autopsies, and three-quarters of them had significant atherosclerotic disease. 10% had more than 75% narrowing. 20% had multivessel disease, average age 26. And this was in 1993, well before our high-fat, high-protein McDonald's diets that had become so popular, right? North, south, east, or east, west, north, mouth. Watch that diet go south. Right? And have you seen what kids nowadays are eating? Childhood obesity is becoming rampant. And there's a lot of pediatric cardiologists that are predicting that in the next 5-10 years, we're going to be seeing more and more and more adolescents having atherosclerotic-related heart disease. Unbelievable. Now, I have to show this to you. This is Baltimore. Actually, this is what I intended. I found this on the internet. You all are familiar, I'm sure, with Michelangelo. It's a very famous David sculpture of the, I guess, perhaps typical man in 1504. Some people believe that if Michelangelo were living today, David would look just a little bit different. Okay? So, all right, that's gross. Let's keep going. Okay. All right. What about the elderly? All right. Elderly are another high-risk group. Painless MI is common. 40% of patients over the 65 and the majority of patients over 85 have no pain. Instead, present with shortness of breath or weakness becomes very common over the age of 85. Okay? That elderly patient showing up just with weakness, right? We see this every day. Just get an EKG. All right? You don't have to get troponins or anything. Just get an EKG. All right? Simple test. You'll be surprised. All right? Amongst the angiogenic equivalents, shortness of breath, look at all these neurologic symptoms. Confusion, acute stroke symptoms can be the angiogenic equivalent. Acute weakness, syncope, and then isolated emesis and isolated diaphoresis. Just get an EKG, right? It's inexpensive, it's rapid, reliable. How much does an EKG cost? It's a piece of paper and ink. That's it. All right, it's a cheap test and it gives you a better yield than just about anything else. Malaise and loss of appetite become very common over the age of 85, all right? Diabetics, we all worry about diabetics. There's actually a new standard in the U.S. and in international cardiology thought process about diabetes. Diabetes is no longer considered an atherosclerotic disease risk factor. Diabetes is now considered an atherosclerotic disease equivalent. That's how bad diabetes is now believed to be. In fact, diabetics who get admitted with negative cardiac enzymes have the same in-hospital mortality as non-diabetics with positive enzymes. That's how bad diabetes is now believed to be. So consider bumping up the level of care, especially the insulin-dependent diabetics or long-standing diabetics. All right? There's a few additional independent risk factors we now know. Add these to your 7 Framingham risk factors. Cocaine. Right? Acute use of cocaine is associated with sticky platelets, adrenergic stimulation, and vasoconstriction. Chronic use of cocaine accelerates atherogenesis, increased risk 7-fold. This is due to systemic inflammation, endothelial dysfunction. A lot of theories about why they do this. People that study cocaine will oftentimes say that the coronary arteries of chronic cocaine users look like patients that are about 20 years older. So when we have a chronic cocaine user, we just add 20 years to their age because that's what their coronaries are going to end up looking like. Lupus. I never learned this. Question. If it's a remote history of cocaine, then they probably had as much risk up until they stopped. But if it's just a remote history of cocaine, then it doesn't continue to progress from that. All right. I don't know that it regresses, though. Question back there? What about meth? People believe it does the same thing, perhaps not. So the question is, what about methamphetamines? Same concept, systemic inflammation, not to the degree of cocaine, though. Okay, so it increases your risk of accelerated atherogenesis, but probably not quite as much as cocaine. Lupus is another tremendous cause of systemic inflammation, and perhaps is one of the greatest risk factors that we didn't really learn about. But this became very popular press after these articles in 2003, and here's what the literature says. Dozens of reports, young people with lupus have a 9 times higher risk for early atherosclerosis compared to age-matched counterparts. Young women have it even worse. 50-fold increased risk of premature atherosclerosis, and patients with lupus will have their first MI 20 years earlier than non-lupus age-matched counterparts. That's how bad lupus is. What else? Chronic kidney disease is also, or HIV is also now known to be an independent risk factor. It accelerates MI risk by about 10 years. And just to add insult to injury, if your HIV-positive patient is compliant with the protease inhibitors, the risk is even higher because protease inhibitors induce insulin resistance and dyslipidemias. Just to add insult to injury, all right? Chronic kidney disease is now also known to be an independent risk factor. Not only that, but chronic kidney patients oftentimes have hypertension, smoke, and have a bunch of other cardiac risk factors. But chronic kidney disease all by itself is associated with metabolic factors. I'm not going to go through these in detail. These are in your handout. And a handful of other risk factors. And even though they get frequent boluses of heparin on their dialysis, it doesn't matter. They still end up having accelerated atherosclerosis. So here's your new list of cardiac risk factors, the 7, plus add cocaine, lupus, HIV, chronic renal disease, and pretty much any other systemic inflammation. But I got to tell you, honestly, that probably the greatest risk factor in all of cardiology for premature atherosclerosis has not even been published yet. The greatest risk factor in all of cardiology for premature atherosclerosis is nothing more than simply bad luck. Right? I mean, we've all seen it. People that have no hypertension, they keep their sugars in check, they eat right, they're good husbands or wives and good parents, and all they've got is bad luck, and they drop dead. Every one of us probably knows somebody for whom that's happened. This is clear. And the problem is, this is a retrospective risk factor. You don't know it when they present. Right? People don't show up in the emergency department and say, yeah, I've got diabetes, I smoke, and I've got bad luck. Right? Now, how many residents are there? Here, raise your hands. Okay, so I worry a little bit about you guys because you don't have the experience yet to know that how bad luck is in terms of risk factor. So I want to put this in terms that you guys can understand. You see a lot of trauma patients in your residencies. Think of it this way. Bad luck is as big a cardiac risk factor as the words, I was just minding my own business. It's a risk factor for penetrating trauma. Okay? Now you understand how bad luck is. All right. This is a tremendous risk factor in Baltimore. In fact, there's some recent studies saying that if you're just minding your own business in Baltimore, there's about a 70% likelihood you're about to get shot or stabbed. So, all right. Okay. Now, the last 15 minutes or so, let's talk about this. All right. In the patient presenting with chest pain, let's say you walk in the room, you do your old car, your HPI, and you walk out of the room and you say, this person needs to be admitted. Then you go over and look at some old medical records and you find out that they recently had a quote-unquote negative stress test or maybe a negative or a fairly normal-looking cath. What do you do now? How comfortable do you feel maybe sending that person home at this point? Right? You're worried about your HPI, but you've got these records on the chart. Well, before you answer that, let me present this type of case. 63-year-old, this is a patient that one of my colleagues saw, right arm and right hand pain, visiting Baltimore's Inner Harbor from Philadelphia. He came in because of his right arm and hand pain. Now he's asymptomatic. He's had two recent negative stress tests, all right, according to a cardiologist that one of my colleagues called in Philadelphia. Despite that, there was another cardiologist that said, you know what, I'm taking you to the cath 3 months ago. And he had a 70% RCA lesion and minimal LAD disease. Okay, so point number one, he's got a 70% RCA despite two negative caths or two negative stress tests. Okay? So what happens? He gets an EKG, it's read as normal, bunch of labs get sent off, everything's looking normal. He says, Doc, I feel fine, it's getting late, I want to head back to Philadelphia. I got a two-hour drive in front of me. His 70-year-old girlfriend's kind of sitting there saying, you know, when are we going to go? So finally, he goes out to the waiting room, and he gets discharge papers, he goes out there, and his girlfriend, again, 70 years old, she's looking for this car, right? She's walking up and down the parking garage, 45 minutes, she can't find the car, all right? Fortunately, while he's sitting out there in the waiting room, he starts having recurrence of this right arm and hand pain. Nobody does anything. He's been discharged. Right? Then he starts getting a little diaphoretic and pale. Nobody does anything. He's got his discharge papers. He's going to have to re-register. Right? And then the one thing happens that immediately calls attention to everybody. He vomits. So immediately he gets brought back in. They repeat the EKG. He's got tombstones across his precordium. And about a minute later, he loses pulses. They defibrillate him, he goes to the cath lab, he actually ended up doing okay. And it wasn't the 70% RCA that was the infarct-related artery, it was the LAD, which was less than 50% in size, that was the infarct-related artery. Now, his girlfriend did eventually find the car, but had she found the car immediately, he would have been on I-95 heading north when he had his cardiac arrest. So somebody was looking out for this guy, all right? But I thought invasive testing and stress testing were the gold standard for cardiac disease. Invasive testing, cath, and stress tests, this is as all-American and as true and reliable as baseball, motherhood, and apple pie, right? But what have we learned? As we get older in life, we start realizing that a lot of the things that we thought were good and pure in life turn out not to be quite so good and pure anymore. Right? So let's talk a little bit about corneal angiography. What's the purpose of angiography? Well, I'll tell you what I learned. I learned the purpose of angiography is to identify big plaques because it's the big plaques that are at risk for rupture. In fact, a lot of the cardiologists will still say 75% is the magic number. 75% and up, that's a significant plaque. It's going to rupture. You got to do something about it. Under 75%, they call that minimal disease. Some people go by 50%, minimal disease. You see that on cath reports all the time. All right, 70% is the most common quoted number. What's the purpose of stress testing? This is a non-invasive method of detecting big lesions. Essentially, what you do is you take a patient, you plop them on a treadmill, and stress their heart. And what you want to see is whether they can meet their myocardial oxygen demand. If their coronaries are occluded, the coronary arteries will not supply enough blood to meet the demand. They'll develop ischemic chest pain, EKG changes, or if it's a nuclear medicine test, and instead of putting them on a treadmill, you're injecting vasodilators, okay, to stress them, then you have positive perfusion tests. That's essentially what stress testing is all about. It's a non-invasive way of seeing whether somebody's got big lesions. Well, there's a couple problems here. If you actually look at the literature, at best, stress testing is only about 85 to 90% sensitive for detecting large lesions, and that's using size as and angiography as your gold standard. We'll talk about what the problem is about using the angiography. All right. It's also reader dependent, like all imaging studies. If you've ever sat in the room with cardiologists that are reading the cath report, it's very interesting. You know, one of them will say, well, what do you think, 70%, 60, 65%. It's not an exact science at all, because it's reader dependent, okay? There's also, this is the big thing that you got to be aware of if you haven't heard this already, recent data, recent meaning over the past 15 or 20 years, this was first reported in the pathology literature, but just started making its way to cardiology and still hasn't really made its way to emergency medicine, right? Pathologists have known about this stuff for 20 years. What do they say about pathologists? They know everything, but just a day too late. All right. So, smaller plaques, it turns out, are more unstable and more prone to rupture. And in fact, the infarct-related artery is less than 50% obstructed in two-thirds of MIs. Two-thirds of the time, the MI occurs in an artery that was less than 50% obstructed before the MI occurred. So, here's a nice little model for plaque composition, right? And the artery at the top is 80% occluded. And that's the plaque that we would worry about. The one at the bottom, 50% occluded. And that would probably give you a negative stress test. It turns out that it's the plaque at the bottom, which is the unstable one, not the one at the top. Because it's not size that matters, it's composition. It's the size of the fibrous cap and the lipid core that determines whether a plaque is unstable or not. And the one at the bottom has a thin fibrous cap and a large lipid core. That makes the plaque unstable. If you take a look, this is a histology section. Obviously, this person didn't do too well. But this is a very stenosed artery. The blue part is thick fibrous cap, and that little white area is lipid core. There's no way this is going to rupture. There's a thick fibrous cap. And look how stenosed it is, actually. This has been growing for 20, 30, 40 years. On the other hand, this is a very unstable plaque. Look how thin the fibrous cap is and how large the lipid core is. And if you're looking at this on fluoro from above down, this looks like a very nice patent-looking artery. Angiography also has problems because angiography only tells you about size. It gives you no information about the cap or the lipid core. It also can't predict vasospasm. Here's a 35-year-old guy who presents to the emergency department a couple of times, rules out and goes home, everything's doing well, then he comes back to the emergency department, and on his third visit, his EKG happened to look like this. 35 years old, not much in terms of cardiac risk factors. He went to the cath lab and had clean coronaries. This was purely vasospasm. And neither stress testing nor angio can predict vasospasm. Despite the clean coronaries, he ended up with a big part of his anterior heart infarcted, and he's living the rest of his life on beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and antiplatelet agents. And New York Heart Class 3 heart failure. So if he does too much exertion, he gets heart failure, right? Clean coronaries. Here's a great review article. It talks about all the different reasons why patients can have false negative cardiac caths. And the one I want to point out at the bottom here is something called coronary artery remodeling, a new concept in atherogenesis, relatively new. We all learned that as plaques grow, they grow from the lumen into the vessel. What we now know is that during the majority of the life of a plaque, it doesn't grow into the vessel. It actually grows outwards into the lumen, and it's spared outward into the vessel wall, and it spares the lumen, which means on angio and stress testing, you get false negative tests, even though somebody may have a big plaque. There's newer technology called intravascular ultrasound. Ultrasounds come so far, they now have probes that are so small, they can put them on the tip of a catheter and feed it inside a coronary vessel and look at the vessel from the inside out. And using this new technology, there's some very interesting things that we're learning about plaques. This is a normal artery. There's just a tiny bit of plaque that the arrow is pointing at. You've got nice thick adventitia, lumens 3 millimeters across. This is a very diseased vessel. By the way, the little circle in the middle is just a reflection of the electrode. You can ignore that. There's a huge semicircular plaque with a very thin fibrous cap. This is a volcano waiting to explode. And yet it's growing backwards into the vessel wall, causing outward bulging of the wall. So there's a huge plaque here. What does this look like? Section A, section B. What does this look like on angio? Here's your angio, section A, section B. This is read as completely normal LAD. And on angio, you have no idea that right next to that arrow at section B is actually a huge plaque. A couple more examples. Again, all of these are from the cardiology literature. References are in your handout. This is read as normal LAD. Here's the intravascular ultrasound. Huge plaque growing in the 7 o'clock direction. Here's another one. This is read as near normal RCA. Huge plaque growing in an eccentric direction south, sparing a relatively normal-looking lumen. How many of you have ever seen a patient who had an MI within a couple of months or weeks of having a relatively normal cath or stress, right? Everybody. Residents, you should take a look at all these hands going up. These are not zebra cases. Right? Question? Good question. So how many people are doing intravascular ultrasound? Only about 1% of centers. This is more done as an investigational thing because they don't have the technology to intervene if they see something. It's mostly just to look at what's going on, but most places don't have the technology to do it. A significant number of casts that are read as normal do actually have disease, and this is probably one of the reasons why. Okay? Now here's a case, 49-year-old visiting from Baltimore, presents with chest pain, shortness of breath, diaphoresis, classic symptoms. He goes all the way to the cath lab and is found to have a 40% RCA, 20% left circumflex lesion. He's discharged. 2 days later, he flies back to Arizona. And as he's getting out of his airport, he's heading to his car, develops chest pain, taken to a local ED, and he's got an acute inferior STEMI, and that 40% RCA is now 100%. So what happened in 2 days? Well, here's probably what his intravascular ultrasound would have looked like. He's got huge plaque, and notice that there's jagged borders. That means the plaque recently ruptured. This is your classic unstable angina. And so when they read the cath is 40% occluded, does that mean that it's been 40% occluded for 10 years? Or does that mean that it's 40% occluded today, and it was 10% occluded yesterday? And right now he's got an unstable plaque. So the bottom line here, and I'm wrapping up, is that I'm not trying to tell you that stress testing and angiography are useless. I'm definitely not telling you that. But the problem that we're seeing over and over in the legal literature and legal cases against emergency physicians and cardiologists is that they walk out of the room saying, I'm definitely admitting this person, and then they look at this negative cath or stress test recently, and they risk stratify the patient to zero. There is nothing that risk stratifies you to zero. It may lower your concern, but don't make that mistake or this will happen. This is a real case. 56-year-old woman comes to the ED with substernal pressure, diaphoresis, and belching. Now, this is a slam dunk admit in anybody's emergency department, right? EKG is non-diagnostic, so what? We're admitting her. Emergency physician walks out of the room, calls up the primary and says, we need to admit her. But the primary says, you know what? She had a negative stress test 2 months earlier, and the cardiologist diagnosed her with reflux. Send her home. So purely because of that negative stress test, the patient goes home and is dead the next day. A lawsuit is brought against the emergency physician, and at deposition, the plaintiff attorney looks right in the emergency physician's eyes and said, "Doctor, didn't you know that stress testing is only 85% sensitive? And if you were worried about your HPI, you should have admitted her regardless." And so they settled the case for an undisclosed amount. I'll get to the question in just a second. All right. This says, "Your Honor, before we settle on a judgment amount, we'd like to know how much money there is in the universe." So, future, again, there's other lectures that talk about the future. A lot of people are thinking that maybe CT will replace angiography. That's weighed against a lot of people that are concerned about the risk of cancer from CT. One of the benefits, and I'm not pushing CT, but one of the things that CT shows is it does show remodeling. Here's a 40-some-year-old guy that had a negative stress test that they did a CT on, and you can see that he's got a huge area of intramural clot right outside the dye. All right. So the vessel wall is extending outside here, and the dye only shows a slight occlusion. He's got a huge plaque right there. Okay, so let's sum things up. All right, covered a lot of stuff. If you remember what's on the next couple of slides, you'll be good to go with this lecture. Okay? Always recognize the possibility of atypical presentations. Chest pain is not always present. Beware that reflux diagnosis, and remember that diaphoresis is bad. Don't discount the risk in young patients, women, elderly, diabetics present atypically. Add cocaine, lupus, HIV, and chronic kidney disease to your list of risk factors. Don't ignore concerning HPI just because of a negative test. Your HPI is the most important thing you've got going. All right? Remember, nothing risk stratifies to zero. Be thorough with your documentation because this is the one thing that's going to save you if you end up in court. Document, document. Don't put red flags on the chart of a patient you're going to send home. And that occurs in a lot of cases. Person gets sent home and you look at the chart and there's pressure, diaphoresis, radiation to the left arm. Okay? Scribble them out. No, I'm just kidding. No. Think twice. Maybe that person needs to be admitted. And remember rules 1 and 2. Never say it's not your heart. You're going to miss some. Do what's best for the patient, not your buddy upstairs. If you remember these simple things, hopefully you'll be able to avoid the lawyers that are out there. With that, I want to thank you very much. I'll be happy to take questions on the outside. Okay?
Thank you for listening. This concludes this session.